From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Adam Klein. He's the Robert M. Gates Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and that's a policy group based here in Washington. The chair was named after former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who served under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Adam's research centers on the intersection of national security policy and law, including government surveillance in the digital age, counterterrorism, and rules governing the use of military force. He also has a keen interest in transatlantic cooperation on these issues and the future of transatlantic relations in general. Before coming to CNAS, Adam served as a law clerk to the late Justice Antonin Scalia of the U.S. Supreme Court. He has also worked on national security policy at the RAND Corporation and the 9/11 Public Discourse Project. That's the nonprofit successor to the 9/11 Commission. And of course, 9/11 refers to the September 11th terror attacks on U.S. soil in 2001. Adam Klein began his career as a legislative assistant in the office of the late Republican congressman from the state of Florida, Bill Young. And Adam Klein joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
And as always, I'm so delighted to welcome our national security correspondent, Jeff Selden.
My pleasure.
Well, Adam, let me first begin with your interest in transatlantic relations, the fact that we just witnessed the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, and we saw rather strained relations between the Trump administration and the European Union countries and some of the other G20 countries. We saw differences on the Paris Climate Accord, international trade, and immigration. What impact, in your view, is this sort of strained relationship between the Trump administration and some of these countries having on this ever-present terrorist threat in Europe, many foreign fighters coming back from Iraq and Syria, and some of the homegrown jihadis?
Well, that's a great question. First, I'd like to say that as a former Robert Bosch fellow, I spent a year in Berlin, Germany. I've also studied French for many years. So this is a relationship that's personally important to me and where I have a fair amount of personal experience. I think it's important to introduce a bit of historical perspective here. During the Reagan administration, there were significant transatlantic tensions over things like the deployment of U.S. intermediate range ballistic missiles in Western Europe with nuclear weapons, obviously. During the second Bush administration, we saw significant tensions over the Iraq War. And I think the pattern we've seen throughout these tensions, which to some extent derive from the U.S. and Europe different geopolitical positions in the post-war era, to some extent, some have argued from inherent differences in outlook between Americans and Europeans. But the pattern that we've seen is that eventually both sides find their way back to working together. And I think that's what will happen here as well eventually. And the reasons for that are both based in our common values, which are much deeper than the things that divide us, but also the ways that we need each other. And those are a persistent dynamics in the relationship. So just to give a few examples, the transatlantic relationship is by far the world's most significant trading and economic relationship. If you look at the numbers, they're vast. The amount of foreign direct investment going both ways across the Atlantic is surprisingly huge if you drill down into the numbers and compare it to the overhyped investments in other parts of the world, frankly. In counterterrorism, which you mentioned, there's a very deep cooperation and information sharing. And candidly, we've seen a lot of European pushback on certain issues lately, but they need our assistance on counterterrorism, and our intelligence services are consistently and very willingly providing it, as we should be. I've been told in confidential settings that the ratio of counterterrorism data that the U.S. sends to Europe is 9 times greater than that which we receive back in return. It's not a value judgment one way or another, but we are providing very great behind-the-scenes assistance to European counterterrorism, and I think ultimately these dynamics will bring the relationship back together.
So notwithstanding these tensions, that counterterrorism relationship and intelligence sharing remains strong and robust.
It does. I've heard, again, from sort of confidential discussions, that in the wake of the Paris attacks, one of the first things that French authorities did was to contact the U.S. intelligence community and ask it to use its collection capabilities to target those who were suspected of perpetrating the attack. And there are very good reasons for that. The U.S. invests very heavily in these capabilities, and we use them not only to protect ourselves, but also to protect our allies. And again, that's as it should be.
Let me turn to my colleague Jeff Selden for a question.
Just following up on this line of thought, Is there a difference between the personal relationships that people in the U.S. intelligence communities and the European intelligence communities have forged, and then the trust that exists right now, or perhaps the lack of trust that exists with the administration? And what type of tension could that cause? And how do you see the European countries and the U.S. moving beyond that? On the lower levels, obviously, there's a desire and a very good relationship. But when you talk to Western diplomats, European diplomats, you do hear there's some skepticism, there's some concern about how the administration is pursuing its path right now.
I actually think there's more parallel there between the intelligence-to-intelligence community relationships and the politician-to-politician relationships than maybe the question suggests. So on the intelligence side, obviously, these are professionals. They're career professionals. They're in the same secretive world with the same norms and understandings, and they've worked together for many years. So there's a deep connection there that's hard to sever. On the political side, again, these are people who are very pragmatic, who have to work together to get things done. And so ultimately what we've seen is that leaders find a way to work together on topics of mutual interest, even if the interpersonal dynamics are fraught. I think where the challenge is, and maybe this is what you were getting at a bit, is that we need public support ultimately to underpin all of this collaboration. So if the public is vehemently opposed to relations with the United States in a given country, it will be difficult for that country's leaders to work with the United States collaboratively. Similarly, if the public is opposed to, say, intelligence sharing with the United States or is concerned about U.S. intelligence activities on its soil, then there will be pressure for that country to push back against those activities and to cut off that cooperation. And so I think the challenge for the U.S. national security community is to build that trust. Here at home, of course, we always need to do that, but internationally as well, to communicate better to people exactly what the U.S. intelligence community is allowed to do, all of the many legal safeguards that exist that limit those things. And I should add that many of those legal safeguards apply to non-Americans as well. And then also the very, very rigorous oversight mechanisms that we have in place, ranging from Congress to the courts to things within the executive branch. And then finally, and perhaps this is the most important, the transparency measures that the U.S. intelligence community has taken to tell Americans, but also the world, more about what we do.
One follow-up question we could ask is, how long do you think it will be before both the U.S. and Europe find their footing in this regard? Because it's not just that there's a new administration in the U.S. There are new administrations, new leadership, and elections that have taken place in Europe, and more elections that are on the way. How long do you see this period of uncertainty lasting, and when does everybody finally get on that same page?
As you point out, elections and upcoming elections always exert a certain coercive force on political leaders to demonstrate their independence vis-a-vis other countries. Now, we've got two out of the three significant European elections behind us. We've got the UK elections passed, the French elections passed. Now the German elections are coming up this fall. If, as looks likely, Angela Merkel is reelected, that will take some of that pressure off her, presumably, and make it easier for her to work pragmatically with the U.S. administration. I think that cooperation will be positive for all sides. But to some extent, this depends on events which we cannot yet forecast. So additional crises in the Middle East that require transatlantic cooperation, that would certainly bring the parties together faster than we might otherwise anticipate. Other economic crises that require transatlantic cooperation, again, that could push the parties back together. And of course, there could also be new disclosures or new crises that create additional tension between the U.S. and European partners. The forces that have always drawn us back together still exist and will ultimately draw us back together. We're seeing in Russia the geopolitical pressure that Russia is exerting on Europe's eastern border has certainly placed greater renewed emphasis on the mission of the NATO alliance. We recently saw the president come out and reaffirm the Article 5 guarantee. We've seen Secretary of Defense Mattis being very vocal on that, and Secretary of State Tillerson as well. The U.S. is participating along with a number of other nations in the reassurance initiative in the Baltic states and Poland. So that commitment remains robust, and that will remain a unifying factor for the United States and its NATO allies and European allies.
Adam, I'd like now to turn to this proliferation of cyber attacks around the world. The United States is a victim. Other states, Ukraine, Qatar has been the victim more recently of cyber attacks. Talk about the threat of these cyber attacks, which is almost like a new kind of warfare, and how can we defend against them?
Sure. So there are two ways to defend against any threat. One is to stop it as it occurs. The other is to deter your adversary from conducting them in the first place. On the first element, I think we continue to struggle. We've seen successful cyber attacks, damaging cyber intrusions, I should say, against the United States occur over and over again. Some of the most notable against the U.S. government, so the intrusion into the Office of Personnel Management, a U.S. government agency that maintains the personnel records for millions of government employees. For obvious reasons, that's very sensitive information. Adversary intelligence services would love to have it. And unfortunately, they got it. They were able to get into the Office of Personnel Management systems undetected and exfiltrate tens of millions of personal records about U.S. government employees, people with security clearances. So the people who are of greatest interest to foreign intelligence services. That's a terrible debacle. And so I think that shows that we are far behind where we need to be in terms of cybersecurity. We saw U.S. defense contractors losing the plans to sensitive defense systems, for example, the F-35 fighter. Again, very damaging for national security, showing that we're not yet locking down the information we need to. And then last year in the election, we saw how unconventional types of cyber intrusions, not against the government, but against political organizations, can still be a very effective tactic for adversary nations. And as a society, we're not yet doing enough on the defensive side. But that's only one side. The deterrent side is the other side. The good news for Americans and for our allies is that based on the publicly available information, it looks like the United States is leading the way in developing offensive cyber capabilities that can scare people away from doing these things if we wield them effectively. I should add that responses to cyber intrusions and cyber attacks need not occur and should not occur only in the cyber realm. An adversary may choose to challenge us there, but we may deem it best to respond in the diplomatic realm with economic sanctions. And President Obama issued an executive order permitting economic sanctions against malevolent cyber actors, which was a good step. We can use traditional military means if the attack is severe enough. So the United States needs to use the full spectrum of its national power, working together with all of its international allies and partners to respond to these cyber events and make clear that certain lines cannot be crossed.
Do you see a commitment in that realm under the Trump administration thus far?
I think it's too soon to say in cyber-specific terms how the Trump administration intends to respond. I mean, I think we saw in Syria that the administration is prepared to act swiftly when it views the U.S.'s vital national interests being at stake. But the challenge that multiple administrations have had in the past in responding to cyber activities is that the waters can be muddy. It's not always clear who the foreign actor is, or even if it is clear to us, it's difficult for us to persuade other countries that we have a clear attribution of who the malevolent actor is. And then sometimes we've seen administrations respond outside of the public realm and then not necessarily get full credit for having responded.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. We're talking with Adam Klein. He's the Robert M. Gates Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and that's a policy group based here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. And this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout-out to a loyal fan from Turkey, Mert Ocalik. Teşekkür ederim. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And also, we'd love to know what you think of VOA's Press Conference USA. We'd appreciate it if you would take our brief online survey. You can find it on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Carol Castiel. And now let me turn to Jeff Selden for a question.
Just want to follow up on the way that the U.S. has been taking measures to improve cybersecurity. And it seems one of the challenges that has existed for some time is defining exactly what things are in cyberspace. In the real world, in the non-virtual world, if somebody attacks you, you know what it is. If there's an act of war, it's easy to define. But in cyberspace, it seems finding the legal definitions and the legal framework in which to operate has been a little bit more difficult. As somebody who looks at the intersection of cyber and legal matters, where do you see this going? And is the world as a whole any closer to being able to define what it's talking about when it talks about cyber war, cyber attacks? And will that in any way make it easier for countries to respond or know how to respond in any sort of measured way?
I think we need to start with international law, what it means and how it works. International law is not like the law in a domestic context where you have a court system that says what the law is dispositively, where you have police that enforce those judgments, and where you have a legislature that can change the law with absolute authority. It's much more fluid. You have some treaties like the UN Charter, but you also have this nebulous body of customary international law. And the way that comes into being is that states over time adhere to a certain principle for the reason that they believe it to be legally required. Those are the two elements. There has to be state practice that's consistent and general, and that practice has to occur not merely because it's convenient, but because states agree and think that something is the law. And so we're really at the beginning of that process with determining how the rules governing use of force apply to cyberspace. And so I think the indeterminacy and the uncertainty that exists here shouldn't panic us. It's an inherent part of how international law works and develops. I think it's appropriate for the United States to take a leading role together with like-minded countries that share our values and share our view of the world in helping to determine what we think the law should be. That's how it's always worked in customary international law. Countries have to say what they think the law should be in order for it to eventually crystallize into what the law is. And the United States has actually done that in certain areas. The State Department's legal advisor in the last administration came out and listed a number of things that, in the view of the United States, would rise to the level of an armed attack under the UN Charter that would trigger the US's right of self-defense. So, for example, cyber attacks resulting in the loss of life or widespread damage, analogous to those kind of effects that a traditional military attack would create. Another example is something that causes a financial panic. So, for example, tampering with bank balances or with the currency system could create a widespread hysteria. And that's obviously something that the United States cannot and should not tolerate and that no nation would tolerate. And so we're starting to see that these red lines are starting to become defined. Obviously, they're not universally accepted. They haven't hardened into formal international law yet. But if the United States expresses its view and other countries express their view, eventually a consensus will start to emerge.
You know, since the terror attacks on 9/11, 2001, we found that electronic surveillance is more vital than ever for counterterrorism and other intelligence gathering. You know, some argue, though, that the United States is becoming a growing surveillance state that potentially threatens Americans' privacy and freedom. So how do you respond to that age-old question that we've been faced with? What is the proper balance between privacy and national security in free societies and in democracies?
I don't think it's for me to say what the proper balance is for everyone, for every society, and for all time. This is why we have democratic institutions, to make these judgments, to revise them as circumstances change, to ensure that they reflect the values of each society and the preferences of society. With the U.S. Constitution, we have some fairly stringent limits on what the government can do. So, for example, we have the Fourth Amendment, which governs searches and seizures of the papers, houses, persons, and personal privacy of people in the United States, and to some extent of Americans overseas. And so that puts a ceiling on the type of things that the government can do in the search and seizure realm, including the Supreme Court has said electronic surveillance. So obviously that the constitutional limits are absolute and we can't go beyond that. But even within the range of the things that the Constitution would allow, there's a whole range of possible choices from fairly substantial national security powers to fairly limited and weak national security powers. And obviously the choices that the public makes evolve with events that happen in society. So after the 9/11 attacks, the public naturally demands more stringent measures, more expansive protections to prevent future attacks. Whereas after something like the Edward Snowden leaks in 2013, public concern moves the other direction. People start to become concerned about privacy. And then we saw after the Snowden disclosures, various measures from Congress, from the executive branch, trying to raise the standards of privacy in the intelligence community.
That leads me to ask you about the U.S. government vis-a-vis digital communication platforms like Google, WhatsApp, Twitter, and Facebook. For national security reasons, as you well know, the U.S. government often wants data from these firms. So again, you know, what would be the proper response from these firms? Do they comply? Do they fight? Or is there some middle ground?
this is not just the U.S. government, it's every government. Every government is getting data from its own local companies, and every government is requesting data from these big U.S. firms as well. They all put out annual transparency reports, and they document the number of requests that come from every country. So I would encourage citizens of every country that who are listening to this show to go onto Google's website, to go onto Apple's website, look at the transparency reports. The companies are very forward-leaning in putting these out and trying to show their users that they are being transparent. To these companies specifically, in the past, when telecommunications mostly flowed over monopolies, those companies are very closely regulated by the government, and accordingly, they had very close relationships with their governments and even collaborative relationships with their governments. There's a famous story of the U.S.'s first signals intelligence office that was in the State Department. And when this fellow who started the office wanted to get access to other countries' diplomatic messages, he simply walked down to the Western Union office and asked for the messages. And the Western Union, which of course was this great communications monopoly, the clerk handed them over to this very impressive looking government official who came to ask for them. So when you have these closely regulated companies whose existence really depends on the government, they have a very profound incentive to cooperate with the government. Now we're in a completely different age here in the digital world. You have these companies like Google, like Apple, like Amazon, like Facebook that are in this hyper-competitive environment globally. So they have to compete for users around the world, and their users can usually switch to something else pretty quickly. Some people might push back on that and say that Facebook or Google has a monopoly. I don't think that's true. If you lose your confidence in Google search, you can switch to Microsoft Bing in 1 second. If you lose confidence in Facebook, you can switch over to Snapchat. So these companies really have to compete vigorously for users around the world. They also have to compete for employees. And many of the employees out in California and in the tech sectors around the world have a very libertarian outlook. They don't want their employer collaborating with the government. And so all these incentives are pushing these companies to demonstrate their independence from the government and to push back to some extent against government surveillance requests. And that has made these companies really a leader in the push for transparency about intelligence practices and for legal controls on intelligence and surveillance practices. And on balance, that's probably a healthy thing for society. Obviously, anything can be taken too far. But we've seen that companies have been involved in some court cases and some freedom of information requests that have produced useful transparency for the public.
We have to find a balance. Privacy is important, but so is our national security. It's striking that balance. Let me turn to Jeff for another question.
Have you seen anything lately that gives you any sort of hope that perhaps both sides are finding or starting to reach for more of a middle ground as opposed to the they all talk a good game right now, but in a lot of ways it seems nothing has really changed?
The desire of overseas law enforcement agencies to get access to data held by U.S. companies. And there are very good reasons for that. So if your local police agency in your country is investigating a crime and one of the suspects was using a Gmail account, that very important evidence will be held by an American company. And if that data is stored in the United States, unfortunately, U.S. law prohibits that company from giving that information directly to your government. Your government has to go through our Justice Department through a very complicated and time-consuming process, and that can be a bad thing for investigations. So I think everyone of good faith, including Americans, including these companies, and I know they feel this way, want those law enforcement agencies to be able to investigate serious crimes in their countries. And so now we've seen a movement bringing together companies, bringing together foreign governments, bringing together the U.S. government to try to come up with a solution that allows all governments, regardless of geography, to get access to legitimate data that they need for legitimate law enforcement investigations. You're seeing movement in Congress, you're seeing movement in the executive branch to try to get a solution that enables everyone to get data, regardless of where the data is stored, if their government has legitimate interest in it.
Across the world, we see this movement to withdraw with Brexit, even with the U.S. President Trump campaigning on the idea of America first and making America the priority over some of the allies. Other countries have seen this too, where they're pulling back from these alliances. Yet in the cyber realm, with the need for this information, it seems the draw is going the other way, where there's a need to break down boundaries because it doesn't help anybody if Belgium is investigating potential terrorists, but their communications data is held by a company in California, which they can't access.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think it's incumbent on political leaders and on intelligence and counterterrorism leaders to bring this stuff above the surface so that the public can see all the ways in which we are mutually dependent on one another for our security. But to do that, we need information sharing. And to have that information sharing, we need mutual trust. None of us can do this alone in the counterterrorism realm. And we do have very good cooperation, but the public needs to know about it. And this applies to European officials with particular force, frankly, because you see in the public discourse in Europe massive criticism of U.S. surveillance practices, but very little discussion of the degree to which European counterterrorism agencies benefit from and indeed rely on the very same surveillance practices that other European officials are criticizing. And so it's incumbent on those who benefit from those U.S. programs to come out and defend them publicly so that there will be public support for this relationship.
Is this one of the reasons why you said earlier in the show you're optimistic that when it comes to the transatlantic relationship between the U.S. and Europe, that ultimately everybody's interest comes down to these core values and these core needs that they can't do alone?
Yes, I agree with that. I also think we can't underestimate the importance of the values half of the equation. Obviously, we've seen some friction lately, but this friction is all happening within a very, very narrow band. No one is talking about revising the core values on either side of the Atlantic to, say, permit the persecution of journalists who criticize the government, or to permit governments to ban speech or cut back on, for example, economic exchange between the two continents. But fundamentally, we agree on a free market system with democratic government with the protection of individual rights. And while we're disagreeing on some things, it's all within that basic band. And those are not universally held values by governments around the world, unfortunately. So if we believe in those things, which I think both sides still do and will continue to, we have no alternative but to work with one another.
Adam Klein, I want to close on a more traditional, conventional note with respect to counterterrorism, and that is, what in your view does an effective counterterrorism strategy consist of, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan, beyond bombing campaigns and military power options? What other measures need to be taken?
So I think you can divide it into three bands. The first is defense, securing the homeland, securing your vulnerabilities. And it's not quite as fashionable as the sort of military counterterrorism out there in the Middle East, taking down bad guys is, but it's the most important and it's the one that you have the best control over. And I think on that front, the United States and Europe, to perhaps a different extent, have done a pretty good job over the past 15 years in enhancing things like aviation security. So aviation security in the U.S., unfortunately, as we saw in 9/11, was Swiss cheese before those attacks. And there were massive gaping vulnerabilities that the hijackers were able to exploit. We've locked that down substantially since then. We all complain about the hassle of going to the airport, but unfortunately, there's no way around it, because we've seen terrorists will come back to aviation time and time again. They think it offers them a good return on their investment. It gets a lot of attention. It spreads a lot of terror. It's a vulnerable target when a plane is in the air. So we have to secure that. We've done things like port security. We've done things like improving our border security and the coordination of our border agencies. We've spent a lot more money on intelligence and, frankly, on very valuable tools like electronic surveillance. Our local police agencies like the NYPD have developed their own counterterrorism capabilities. They're out there working with communities, vulnerable communities here in the U.S. to try to prevent radicalization. European police agencies have their own counter-radicalization programs trying to connect with their own vulnerable communities. So we're doing all these things on the defensive side that are really, really important. Now, that said, that can't be enough. Those terrorist networks are still out there and we need to go after them and keep the pressure on them. In some ways, we've done a good job of that. We haven't had another 9/11 scale attack in the U.S., in part because there has been relentless pressure on terrorists where they live so that they don't have the geographic space, they don't have the time to sit back, put their feet up, and plan a complex plot like 9/11. But I think what we've learned over the past 15 years is that large footprint invasions of countries, regime change operations, are not the best way to accomplish counterterrorism objectives. Recently, under the Obama administration, in the late years of the Bush administration, and now under the Trump administration, what we've seen is a new approach. Partnering with people who have local legitimacy on the ground, who can provide the bulk of the troops to go against terrorist groups, and then we augment them with our capabilities and things like intelligence, air support, communications. We put special forces advisors on the ground who are hardened warriors, who are expert in working with local armed groups and increasing their capability. And that has worked very well in the fight against ISIS we've seen. But I think you very rightly pointed out a third pillar, which is the long-term ideological dimension. And I think that's where we've done the least, probably because it's the hardest of all three for a Western government to get right. We just don't know that region very well. We don't know the ideological and historical currents that are driving this phenomenon very well. They're very nebulous and hard to get a handle on. Frankly, it's not something that is really in our wheelhouse as a government, as a society, understanding the complexities of religious and cultural and psychological dynamics in very, very different cultural milieu. I think ultimately the answer there is that regional partners, with whatever limited support we can provide, will have to sort this out for themselves and decide for themselves the fate of their own region. We have to support people who are against extremism in the Middle Middle East, in the broader Muslim world, leaders in our own communities who are against extremism. But ultimately, this is going to be for that civilization to resolve, and it's going to have to choose its own path.
Adam Klein is the Robert M. Gates Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Adam, thank you for coming in. We truly enjoyed your insights.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer and producer was Thomas Blondet. Joining me on the program was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.